Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does Christmas mean in America? While for many it is important for sacred reasons, few people could argue that the holiday has at least a dual identity in this country, if not an evil twin. Because for every midnight church visit on Christmas Eve, there is an all-night campout the night after Thanksgiving outside a Best Buy or a Kohl's or a Walmart. For every Advent candle lit, there is a house wrapped in tens of thousands of twinkling candy-colored lights. And for every genuine moment of joy, at least in some families, there are long hours of planning and shopping and stress. In looking to tell the story of Christmas in modern America, Washington Post pop culture and television writer Hank Stuever chose a city close to home. Our home, not his. He spent 3 years in a row sipping eggnog and hanging lights with the good people of Frisco, Texas, and writes about what he learned in his new book, Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. Hank, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me.
What makes writing about Christmas such a perfect topic for a guy who writes about TV and about pop culture?
The reason I wanted to write about Christmas, for 20 years or so, I've been a features writer, and I cover a lot of popular culture things and a lot of celebrity things and a lot of big news, but I really like covering just everyday life, how people live, their daily dramas, and I've always been drawn to, and this is sort of makes me sort of odd as a newspaper reporter, is most reporters don't like being assigned to the suburbs, and I've always found that the best stories are sort of in those sort of oft-forgotten places, off-freeway, off-ramps, old empty stores, or brand-new strip malls or discount funeral homes or roller skating rinks or just whatever, anywhere I can find people sort of living out their daily consumer lives. And so I wanted to do a book about Christmas because Christmas intersects everything in our popular culture. It is sort of the category killer. Christmas is the Walmart of holidays. everything intersects with it. Our religion, our politics, our families, who we were as children, and sort of how we feel about ourselves as adults, and all of our nostalgia is wrapped up in it. Again, a lot of our spiritual lives are wrapped up in it. Even if you're not Christian, you don't get a pass on Christmas in America, and a lot of people struggle with that. And our economy hangs on it. I mean, that's the big thing, is that we are a shopping America. If we don't shop, the economy doesn't go. Long ago, we stopped manufacturing and exporting and just started shopping to the point now where we're two-thirds a shopping economy. And Christmas is, again, the category killer there. In some sectors, half of all retail sales are made at this time of year.
You quote a figure in a book that we spend more on Christmas every year than we're spending on the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Right. In 2006, when I first moved to Frisco and started writing this book, the sum total of what we had spent in Iraq and Afghanistan did not equal one Christmas, which is about $500 billion. And actually, until the federal bailouts started, it was difficult to find any one single number that matches what Americans spend at the holidays. It's bigger than the movie industry. It's bigger than the video game industry. It's bigger than the book industry and the media, all sorts of media combined. It outpaces the defense budget. It outpaced every other sort of federal number that gets tossed around. So really, until we started sending trillions of dollars into AIG and GM, and that's where I started to see numbers that sort of matched the number that the National Retail Federation throws around for Christmas, which is about $500 billion every year.
So talk about how you settled on Frisco. You're from Oklahoma originally.
Right. I was born and raised in Oklahoma City. I left there. I've worked all over the country. And I was looking for a place that sort of manifested the 21st century in America. I don't think, as we all know, it's not really about cities. There's a lot of re-urbanizing and resuscitating America's cities, but really most people live in the suburbs or really even the exurbs, or if you want to get sort of geography of nowhere with it, the ruburbs. There's all sorts of names the further you go. And so I started looking at demographics. I knew I wanted to write a book about Christmas. I knew I wanted to move to somewhere that had a whole heck of a lot of chain retail shopping, since I knew that the economy would be a big part of the book. And I was looking for a place that had a lot of new neighborhoods, new churches, new everything, really. I feel like, the suburban flight has sort of magnified itself and promulgated itself to a degree that people really do look for. And, you know, nobody's from anywhere anymore. One thing that's interesting about this book is there's not a lot of capital T Texas really about Frisco. There's a lot of people who lived in a Frisco equivalent outside of Atlanta or outside of Kansas City or outside of Los Angeles who relocated to Frisco on the relo, you know. So Frisco was interesting to me demographically, but I considered a lot of places. I looked at suburbs outside of Columbus, Ohio. In fact, when I wrote the book proposal, I thought I was moving to, you know, the suburbs outside of Columbus. But I saw Frisco on a reporting trip down here to Dallas. I did a couple of stories in March of 2006, one of which was about the high-end Walmart. Do you remember when they opened the Walmart in Plano and it was going to only serve the high-end customer? And I knew I was working on a book proposal and was looking for a place. And somebody said, you have to go see Frisco. And I said, how far is that from Plano? I just didn't know that it had grown to the degree that it had. But the minute I drove up there, I was just completely enchanted in a way and a little frightened by just sort of the scope of, you know, it's up there by the IKEA at 121. Highway 121 and the tollway. And, you know, around that IKEA and Stonebriar Center, there's 5-6 million square feet of chain retail. And I was just like, well.
Which is something they boast about in the literature.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, you know, I mean, you can measure these things a variety of ways, but some developers have said that's the highest concentration in a square mile than you'll find anywhere in the Southwest.
Of chain retail.
Yeah. Chain restaurants, chain shopping, big box stores. The houses, you know, are all large. You know, I think the average runs around 3,000 square feet. The families are all new. Lots of little kids. If you're going to do a book about Christmas and tell a story about Christmas, you'd want a lot of children around because Christmas is for and about children, and a lot of churches. And that's a big part of it. I think that to do a book about Christmas, I had to go where I could find the most baby Jesus, you know.
Frisco's where you found the most baby Jesus.
Right.
Well, you know, what's so interesting about that, though, Hank, is that, you know, you can sort of look at Christmas two different ways. You can either say it's a religious holiday and all the other stuff gets in the way, or you can say religion, you know, for certain people doesn't matter so much and they just embrace the holiday. I wonder if you think there are two separate Christmases or if they've just become so entwined that we can't possibly pull one from the other.
Well, what you're doing is you're trying to extricate one kind of myth or belief and another kind of belief. You have Santa Claus and Jesus sort of neck and neck, and they go together for people. People celebrate the birth of Christ and also love to participate in the secular Santa Claus North Pole, you know. And it's a sort of a schizophrenic's not the right word, but we do have a sort of national mental problem, sort of reconciling the Christmas we think we should be having with the Christmas that we've got. And that manifests itself in just feeling like you're not perfect enough at Christmas time, or you're not doing Christmas big enough or well enough, or your Christmas has gotten out of control and you're trying to scale it back. And
which is another kind of stress.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, we're women get a terrific amount of stress at Christmas since the Victorian age, actually. And, you know, the Christmas that we think is so ancient and millennia old is American Christmas is really about 150 years old. It is fused on to the Nativity. It is fused on to the Roman Catholic calendar that decided in the 4th century to put it in December so that it could match the pagan festival of Christmas. I mean, there is a very complicated history of Christmas that almost everybody gets wrong. But the Christmas that we have where Santa Claus gets in a sleigh and comes down the chimney and everybody gathers around the fireplace and sings songs and all of those ideas are relatively recent, sort of fused on to, you know, old world tradition, but sort of not, you know, and really it doesn't really come into play until we have mass marketing and television. Television really tells us how to have a perfect Christmas. You know, everybody wants to be the couple with the diamond. You know, he went to Jared, or that Lexus in the driveway
with the big bow.
Yeah,
where do you buy those bows?
Yeah, they give you one if you buy the car. Yeah.
Is that true?
That's true. Yeah. So you know, television really sort of does a number on us for in a lovely way too. I mean, Christmas is not complete without our Charlie Brown special and the Grinch and one or two or 400 versions of A Christmas Carol, and It's a Wonderful Life. and Ralphie and the BB gun on for 24 hours a day. I mean, if we did not have television and television commercials, I'm not sure we'd know how to do Christmas. You know, it sort of keeps all those myths alive at once.
Well, it's so interesting because people don't seem to look at those commercials in a cynical way very often. You know, people cry when Peter comes home with Maxwell House coffee or whatever.
I love that commercial.
I know, me too. It's been on since we were
kids. Peter's home, and they still show it. And and Peter sets his big knapsack down and makes coffee, and the family wakes up.
He looked about 35 that year he came home from college, so I don't know. But you know, it is funny because you make this point, and it comes up over and over, that people sort of compare their perceived happiness with what they have seen in ways that realistically people don't expect themselves to look the way the people on TV do. But somehow we feel like we're failing if Christmas isn't this transcendent experience.
Right. And I'm very keen to that as a reporter. I always have been. I've done stories about people's weddings. I've done stories about a funeral home. I've done stories where people are in moments of extreme happiness and joy and moments of grief. And I like to look at all of it. I think I would be a bad reporter if I came and tried to do a story about the modern American experience of Christmas without doing both of those things, you know, the joy and the grief and the weird feelings that come along with Christmas and being around your family and trying to find the right thing for everybody. After all these years, you're still trying to find the right presents for one another. And the sort of guilt that we get back from the retail industry about how we're not shopping enough, the economy is endangered. If only the American consumer, that's you, that's me, if only we would get out there and shop more.
Well, they report on like sports scores. Every day you hear how much people are buying.
Right. And yesterday, you know, well, in October it went up 0.2%. And that's really bad. You know, that's really flat, and it's been flat for a long time. Everybody's just kind of waiting for Americans to get to the mall again. And I don't know that they're going back. I don't really put a lot of faith in a recovery that still waits for people to get out their credit cards and overspend.
You spend a lot of time is it Stonebriar Center?
Stonebriar Center Mall. I'm going to be there tonight. I'm going to be reading in the Barnes & Noble there. So it's like going back to where it all began. Yes, I did. Stonebriar Center is Frisco's mall. For people who haven't been there, it was built in 2000. On a former pasture that the city of Frisco worked for years to develop into a shopping mall in sort of a dead heat with Plano to build, you know, the 1.1 million square foot mall that would be. And it's a regional mall. It draws people from Arkansas, Oklahoma. I went there first in probably the spring of 2006 and then sort of changed my mind. I said, I'm going to do this book in Frisco. So I went there every day, starting in about late August of 2006, sometimes twice a day. Every day that I lived in Frisco, and that was initially a 7-month period, I went to the mall once a day, if at minimum.
Is it a microcosm of society or of just a certain segment of society?
It's a microcosm of, I'm going to go ahead and just say society, because I'm fascinated by the levels of income and type and stereotype and kinds of people that make their way through Stonebriar Center on a given day, and especially a Saturday.
My guest is Hank Stuever. He is a television writer for The Washington Post. His new book is called Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Hank Stuever is my guest. He writes about pop culture for The Washington Post. His new book is called Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about the families that you follow very closely for the book. You followed several and then sort of divided it down to three that really represented the essence of what you were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
The first one you describe in the book is this woman, Carol Cavazos, who you met camped outside a Best Buy store?
Yeah, on Black Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Carol was actually the last person I found. When I got here in September 2006, you know, I just started going around to like different meetings, public meetings. I worked out with the moms, the stroller moms at Stonebriar in the morning. You know, I went to like things like Rotary Club and city council meetings, and I met with, you know, counselors, money counselors. I went to job fairs. I was just looking for people. And so for a while, I was just walking around, you know, looking at, could this person be in my book? Could this person? And I started sort of this bulletin board collection of names and phone numbers. But Carol was the last person I found who I wound up considering for the book. And it was really almost divine how I knew I wanted to cover Black Friday. And so that Friday morning after Thanksgiving, I got out there probably around 3 or 4 a.m. And Best Buy opened at 5. And Carol was in the parking lot with her daughter, Marissa. She has three children. Marissa, who at the time was 10, and then her older children, Ryan and Michelle. And Ryan actually was a Best Buy employee. But he had camped out all night in front of the store because, as it happened, he didn't have a shift till later that day. And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, corporate reasons, why the Best Buy employees can't get a jump on the crowd. And there were a lot of things in there that they really wanted that were on sale, a laptop computer and you know, other things, and a computer that Carol and her sister were going to buy for her mom. There were definite good reasons for them to be there, but also she was there because they like being in it. And I didn't get that at first. I'm like one of those people, maybe like you. We see it on TV. We see these people storming, you know, these big box stores at the crack of dawn, and we think, who are these people and why do they do this?
I'd rather pay more.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's an economic concept for that, opportunity cost. Your time is worth something, and you know, you don't want to camp out for a night or two. I mean, the lines get longer every year, and it gets more extreme. But you know, after I did a couple of Black Fridays with Carol and her family, I really I became very tender toward the experience because, you know, we don't say that about, well, we do kind of say that people who run with the bulls in Pamplona, Spain every year, that they must be crazy, but that's viewed as a enriching life experience, you know? And I think we're a little too hard on ourselves in American culture. We tend to view our culture through a prism of trash. We think everything's a little bit trashy and we pass judgment on one another for doing those kinds of things. And I think Black Friday's like running with the bulls or being at Woodstock or, you know, like I think, of course, people want to get out there and they're trying to save money or find one thing. But I think a lot of people are out there because we're just so hungry to be with other people, especially in a place like Frisco, Texas, where you go to work and you park and you probably live in a house with an alley behind it. So you park behind your house and you know, you may be involved with your church. You may not. You may see a lot of people during the day. You may not. You may like the other moms at the school. You may not. But on some level, I think that living in an exurb, human connection becomes extremely valuable.
You know, that's an interesting point because in those experiences, you may be closer, physically closer, shoulder to shoulder with your neighbors than you'll ever be driving your SUV into the garage and letting the door go down before
right.
you go inside.
Right. Well, it's a series of boxes, a 3,000 square foot box that you live in, an SUV box that you drive. Best Buy is a box. There's a lot of air conditioning going on during the really hot parts of the year and a lot of potential for loneliness, for like human loneliness.
So another woman that you profiled, and you did the whole family, but she was really the center of things,
yeah.
was this woman named Tammy, who is in the Christmas business.
She is. Tammy lives in a gated community in Frisco, and her children go to a private school, and she's super involved as a mom and a wife. But a few months a year, she becomes all-consumed with running a Christmas business that she calls Two Elves with a Twist, and she'll hire herself out to decorate your house for Christmas. And as your listeners know, there's no smallness about Christmas in Texas, and this can get quite extreme. You know, in some families, you need a big tree in what I call your lawyer foyer when you walk in, like a 12-foot tree, and the lighted plastic garland going up around the staircase, around the banister. And then you've got your family room with the garland on the mantle and the beautiful, highly decorated and expressively decorated and thematically decorated tree, not just a... You know, then you have your other tree, which has like your Meemaw's ornaments on it. And that's in your family room, and that's your sort of tender family tree next to the big screen. Then you might have your media room tree, and you need a tree in the baby's room. Tammy's favorite tree is in her master bedroom. You can hire her for – and she's not the only one. There are these decorators all over the Metroplex. I feel like a local when I say the Metroplex. I am an interloper, though. There are people all over town who, I guess the rationale, of course, is nobody hangs their own Christmas lights either. You hire your yard crew to come put up your lights because you've seen these roofs on these houses. These are gigantic pitched roof, mini castles.
So. Only a gable will stop you from falling down.
Right. So, if you're going to hire somebody to put up the outside, a lot of people hire someone to put up the inside, too.
So Tammy's a fascinating figure because she's doing this for other people and she's earning, a living this way. She also is, for her own family, trying to recreate this like single magical Christmas itch that she had when she was a kid.
Yeah. Tammy and I spent a lot of time together. We met, Kismet played a role in me meeting all of these families. I met Tammy in October, and she sort of showed me like her scrapbook of her greatest hits, like the jobs that she had done in past years. And she invited me to come with her to Canton to do like the big shopping binge that she does, so she'll have the materials to sell on to her customers. It's a lot of exuberance, a lot of energy. She has so much energy, and it took me a while to realize that why she does it is because. Again, she also yearns for human connection and to know people. And you would spend time with Tammy and think, oh, she's a big gossip because she tells you everything she knows about everybody. But I think she really, really cares. And, I think if I'd spent 3 days with Tammy, I would have been inclined to write about her in a very, a disparaging way, maybe. But the more time I spent with her, the more I realized that she really does believe in the spirit of Christmas and in people's hearts. And she changed me quite a bit. I'm certainly not going to be hanging plastic garland in my own house this year, but
or hiring someone else.
Although I can only give Tammy the full endorsement and it did change me. And she is always searching for that perfect moment, but she found that she was getting too busy. One year that I followed her, she had probably 30 houses. And then the next year, it was more than three dozen. Hmm. And it's cut back a little bit, maybe partly because of the economy. But also, I think that she has realized that the more she does, the less she has time to decorate her own house for Christmas and make her own family feel. She's always in search of what she calls the total moment, which, is elusive. And I think everybody at Christmas time is in search of the total moment, that utter serenity of spirit and home and family and everyone's happy and it all worked out. That's America's search for Christmas. And, so many of us live below the line where it might even snow. One thing I did when I very first started this book was I had a meteorologist draw me a red magic marker line across the United States in Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, United States, because, our white Christmas is just getting rarer and rarer. But so that's why you have places like Frisco Square that make it snow every night, with flakes.
Artificial snow.
Yeah, exactly. It's a real mind messer, these things that we need to make us feel like it's Christmas time, the lengths we go to, the lengths that all the retail establishments go to set a spirit and to find a mood. I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by the great American dance of Christmas that, that everybody has to find their total moment.
The third family that you feature, they don't have kids, but the husband spends just inordinate amounts of time, and he mm-hmm. won't reveal how much money,
right.
getting the house all decked out.
Yeah. This is the Tchaikovsky house, and it's worth driving up to Frisco to see the house. And to not only see the house, but Jeff Tchaikovsky also does an enormous show at Frisco Square, which is Frisco City Hall and one of those mixed-use retail apartment developments. And Jeff puts 150,000 lights on those, or more now, because there are more and more buildings out there that keep getting Christmas lights on them. And on Jeff's own house, Jeff and Bridget have, I guess, probably 50, 60,000 Christmas lights. And the thing about these Christmas lights is that they don't just blink on and off. When you drive by, you tune in the music on your FM dial, and it does a whole dance routine. And it's really very mesmerizing. And the town, you know, Jeff and Bridget are famous in Frisco for their lights, which they've done for many, many years now. The YouTube clip has had 3 million hits. It is interesting to me that they choose not to have children, because if you ask any child in Frisco about their house, they know about it, and about Frisco Square, they know about it. And Jeff and Bridget are I liked them because I was interested in the outside of the house, certainly, being a book about Christmas, but I was definitely interested about the relationships inside the house, the family dynamics, the extended family dynamics, because you can be in that house having a perfectly wonderful conversation or watching them do what they do or wrap presents, unwrap presents, and forget that outside there's this massive light show going on and that there are cars lined up not only in the cul-de-sac but all the way around the block and all the way down Hillcrest waiting to see these lights and waiting to – I'm interested in the people inside the cars too, like what they're thinking, saying to one another while they wait to see these lights, you know, like – family after family after family, again, looking for the total moment and the total Christmas. And the reason Jeff does those lights, you know, well, one, he collects a lot of food for the Frisco Food Bank.
He'll suggest that people drop off a can or
right.
two.
And when people they know to do that. And he probably collects a couple of tons of food every Christmas, which is great. But also, at one point, you know, he gets interviewed by the media a lot because it makes perfect local television to come out there and shoot his house or shoot Frisco Square. And people always ask him, why does he do it? Because it takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and it is his obsession. It is his thing. And one time he explained it to me best, that Frisco is about 105 years old. And really, like Frisco as we know it, you know, in 1990, it was 5,000 or 6,000 people. Now it's over 100,000, most of whom moved here in this decade and who come from other places that also feel sort of rootless. Big houses, big shopping malls, big freeways, big cars, all of it feeling like the last place they lived and the place before that. And I think Jeff is really trying to earnestly fuse a tradition onto Frisco that all of these little children who live there now, they're going to be teenagers and then they're going to be adults, and maybe they'll move away and maybe they'll stay. The ultimate plan is for Frisco to be 250,000 people. Maybe this is like the Christmas that everyone will think back on and remember, oh, we had those lights, or oh, we still have those lights, or we've always had those lights for 30 years. We've had these lights. Like, maybe it will go on that long. You've got to hand it to people who find the thing that becomes the thing, you know, when it comes to Christmas, because every pop star records a Christmas song hoping that that will be the perennial new standard. Every writer, you know, famous novelist, they all throw in a Christmas book sooner or later, hoping that it will take hold and become Christmas specials. Tonight, Mary Madagascar, the Madagascar cartoon characters, are very cynically putting themselves out there for a half-hour Christmas special. Is that the next Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Charlie Brown Christmas? Probably not, but maybe. Maybe it has that magic, you know, and it comes back every year.
So I think anyone who reads the book carefully can see that you do care about these people. But for a certain kind of audience, a certain kind of audience will find nothing but things to disdain about the people that you've written about in the book. Did you worry about that either people who don't know them would misread, or that they would read the book and think, this is not what we showed of ourselves?
All of those things have happened. You know, early on, I explained it to people. Not everybody would have a complete stranger like me spend the kind of time I spent with these people. And it's a real gift on their part, because, you know, this man arrives. He's from Washington. He's friendly, but he's a little off.
a slick big city journalist.
Right. Right.
Moving to Frisco.
There's that going for me. You know, and he wants to you know, it's August, September, and he's talking about following you at Christmas. So what is he going to do between now and then? Well, he's going to, you know, hang out, go to your church, go grocery shopping with you, go to your kids' volleyball games, you know, and take notes until they're sort of comfortable with me being around so that I can really be there for the act of Christmas. And I was, you know, I wrapped presents with Tammy until 1 a.m.
Lots of presents.
Lots of presents. I think each kid got 19 presents that year. So it's a big Christmas in their house. And then, you know, rested a bit and then went over to Carol's house. And at that point, we were so comfortable with one another. And I was trying to figure out, how will I wake her up to let her know I'm there without waking up the whole house? Because I want to see Christmas. You know, I want it to be pure, as pure as it can be with a reporter there taking notes.
So you have keys to the house, essentially.
Well, she left the door open. Mm-hmm. And she said, just come on in and wait by the tree and we'll get up when we get up, you know? And I did. And it was incredibly serene. And we all know that moment. And what a gift to be that close to people that they're anticipating Santa Claus, but they're also leaving the door open for the person with the notebook who, and so, yeah, the book is done. They've all read the book. They read the book this summer when it was in sort of an advanced, you know, galley stage. And, when it was too late to change anything.
Was that deliberate that you gave it to them then?
Yeah, probably. You know, that's a journalistic thing. Like, you know, you really want to, you know, make sure that you've got everything right. I did tons and tons of fact checking with them, but they all didn't read the book until it was finished. And the reactions have been broad. And let me say that I'm sort of done putting words in their mouths or representing what
right.
they really feel.
Right.
I like for them to tell people what they think of the book and to tell me, and I've certainly offered to, you know, if they want me to post something on my website or, you know, whatever. I'm so interested in how they view their own story as well as how I viewed it. But, you know, everybody has something in the book that they probably wish wasn't in there, but they've all reacted very well to it. And as far as the rest of Frisco and the rest of the reading public reading it, the reactions have been really mixed. People think it's insulting to Frisco a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I keep an open mind and I keep asking people to, you know, come to the readings and tell me what you think. And I'm dying to know.
Hank Stuever is my guest. His new book is called Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to be part of it, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Hank Stuever. He is a pop culture writer for The Washington Post. His new book is called Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. Hank will appear at 7 tomorrow night at Legacy Books in Plano for a signing event. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org or at legacybooksonline.com. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rollins asks, did you ever get lonely realizing that these people were part of a transient experience in a land far away, or did it do the opposite and give you that perfect moment?
That's a really good question. To do this book, I left behind my partner back in D.C.
3 years in a row.
Well, yeah, I missed a good chunk of, and he also has a December birthday. You know, so he held down the fort while I moved here. And what I did was I rented a room in what I call a starter McMansion. You know, I found this young couple on Craigslist, and they had a house in Frisco. And I rented like the downstairs bedroom and bathroom suite, and it worked out great. And so every day I would just sort of drive around Frisco and sort of dive into my project of looking for families and looking at Christmas and waiting for Christmas decorations to go up and following night crews who put up decorations in the mall. And I was very busy. But yeah, there was a quality of loneliness to it. I have a lot of friends in Dallas who I would come down and see them a lot for relief, but only one or two of them would ever venture up there. There is a great sort of LBJ, then the George Bush Turnpike, and then 121 divide. Like, the further you're living north, the harder it is to stay contacted with
people. Yeah, you're right. They'll come to shop, but not to visit.
Right. Right. And, you know, but yeah, it was sort of lonely, but it also, you know, I live in a big city. I walk 10 blocks to work every day. The only time we move our car is on Thursdays or Fridays because of the street cleaning. So we put very few thousand miles on our car every year. But I grew up in Oklahoma City. And so a lot of my experience in Frisco and reporting on this book and driving around and going to the mall every day and going to Sonic and getting my Route 44 sized, you know, diet cherry limeade and having the radio on. And it was kind of like being a teenager again. Like I'd suddenly had my driver's license again. And, you know, I was never lonely with these people. These people were very kind to me. Especially as we started spending Christmas after Christmas after Christmas together. And it would be really fun to land at DFW again and get my rental car and get out here, drive up 121 and check into. There was always a brand new, you know, hotel, motel, Hampton Inn, Homewood Suites, A-Loft. I would check into whichever one hadn't been built the last time I was there.
To get the newest experience.
Right. And just sleep like a baby that first night, you know. So I was never lonely, mostly because of these families. They really welcomed me in, and they would say, in one way or another, they'd say, it's like you're part of the family, or it's like you've become this really good friend. And I'd say, yes, and remember that I'm the friend with the notebook who is eventually going to put it all down.
Did you hesitate ever to share details about your personal life because you were there as journalist?
You can't spend any time with Tammy and not give the personal details right away. Like that very first trip that Tammy and I took to Canton in her big red SUV, to buy all that Christmas stuff, she, within 10 minutes, had all the details of my personal life, my partner, things that had happened in his life, things that had happened in mine. She is, she would be a really good reporter.
She could be
the next Bob Woodward. and, you know, Jeff and Bridget were really, everybody was really open to the idea of, you know, who I am, where I came from. I have lived in Texas before. I worked at the paper in Austin before I worked at the Washington Post. I have some family connections to Dallas. I mean, I wasn't like a complete stranger. But yeah, everybody was really interested. In fact, sometimes I'm talkative, right? And I had to remind myself to always listen. Always be as quiet as I can and as unobtrusive as I can to really watch them and listen to them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Renata in Benbrook. Hi, Renata.
Hi.
Hello.
I just have a comment.
Okay.
This, I'm listening to your program. To me, it is outrageous. All this Christmas stuff, all this energy wasted. Why not go back to basics and help people that are lonely, that are hungry, people that don't have anybody. I went personally 10 years ago. I stopped everything. And I'm back to basics. I do volunteer work, seniors that are lonely. That's my Christmas. And I'm more fulfilled than going and looking at all these riches, decoration all over Dallas and Fort Worth. I live in Bamberg. It's the same way. They don't have money, but they have all these decorations.
Renata, thank you so much for your call.
Okay.
Thank you so much. You know, I think, Hank, some of the people that you interviewed and followed felt like Renata, but they couldn't quite break the cycle.
Absolutely. That is the great heartache of Christmas, too, is that it's supposed to bring us so much joy, and it's supposed to be about the spirit of one another and helping one another. And we express it by spending $500 trillion.
On stuff that will get returned.
And I think Renata has nailed it for a lot of people, and I'm glad she called in to say that. I would say that the people in my book do have a real sense of balance. You know, they may wait in front of Black Friday all night long, in a participatory, exuberant way. And they may decorate people's houses and charge $1,000 a day. And they may have 60,000, you know, lights on their house and, you know, sort of in the Clark Griswold National Lampoon Christmas Vacation mode. However, they all have a whole lot of heart and spirit about Christmas, and they are all very attuned to the needs of others. One thing about Renata's Christmas is that is the answer for a lot of people. But that is why the people who most closely watch our economy are so worried about people discovering a truer, simpler Laura Ingalls Wilder, an orange in your stocking Christmas and some dancing to fiddle music later and then spending the day handing out soup at a soup kitchen. If everybody had that sort of Christmas, I mean, on average, we each spend about $1,000 on Christmas presents.
Really?
Yeah. If we each spent about $100 on Christmas, the immediate effects to our economy would be so devastating, and to the global economy, certainly to China's economy. Almost anything you can buy with Christmas on it is made in China. It would put the global economy in a tailspin. So careful what you wish for. A simple Christmas is wonderful, and there's certainly a lot to be said for scaling back and really focusing on only on other people and volunteering at Christmas. All of that is a great suggestion, but I think it would be so dramatically detrimental to the economy in one fell swoop. It would be nice if we could wean ourselves off of Christmas year to year, but even that would be painful.
Since you write about TV now full-time, right? Talk about your favorite Christmas specials, either contemporary or from the 70s when we were growing up.
I personally believe that no one has gotten Christmas more right than the Charlie Brown Christmas special. Charles Schulz and Bill Mendelsohn and Bill Melendez and Lee Mendelsohn. That came out in 1965. Which, in terms of like Christmas traditions, is ancient for Americans. I think that the perfect combination of joy and melancholy that is expressed in the Charlie Brown Christmas special, the simple story. Charlie Brown is sort of metaphorically, he is like Renata. He questions the whole thing. Why do we do this? Why is everybody working so hard to be so happy and unhappy? He encounters a lot of cynicism in Lucy. He goes to get what he thinks is the perfect tree, and it's not glitzy enough for everyone. And then Linus sort of comes in and reads the second chapter of Luke to remind everybody sort of how we got here. And then there's that wonderful Vince Guaraldi jazz soundtrack that just breaks your heart every year.
Makes you want to dance.
Yeah, I think that for me, that's the perfect Christmas special. I have a survey on my website. If people want to go to tinselbook.com, you can take the survey. One of the questions is which Christmas special most is attuned to what you think Christmas is or ought to be. And of course, Christmas Carol is on there, and It's a Wonderful Life, and I threw in some others. And just the other day, A Christmas Story surpassed Charlie Brown. About 23-24% of people like Ralphie and the BB Gun, and that's become a huge tradition. And that movie's only 25 years old. So it does show you that like we can supplant one tradition for another if it's the right thing. And now people line up to see that house in Cleveland where that movie was made. They make pilgrimages to Cleveland to see Ralphie's house and the leg lamp in the window. And you know, we're all pilgrims at heart. We all have sort of a spiritual pilgrimage or a pop cultural pilgrimage to make, whether it's Bruce Springsteen tickets or what, you know.
Well, it is interesting, and you make the point in the book that a lot of people, television is part of Christmas. No matter what it is you watch, there's no getting around it.
I have a story about that. My parents divorced after 29 years of marriage. I was the youngest child. I was still at home. My siblings had all were in college or had moved on. And the year that my parents split, we also got cable. My mother was in a very vulnerable spot, and that's when the lady with the clipboard from the cable company came. And this was 1982. And we cut down a very beautiful tree that year, my mother and I, and it was so big that we had to put it in the what we called the TV room next to our gigantic wood console television that had just been hooked up with MTV. And I was 14, so it was incredibly impressionable. But I still think of all the Christmas specials that were on that year and how nice our TV looked next to our big, beautiful, blinking tree. And to me, they're like inextricably linked now, television and Christmas. You know, watching MTV play and sing Christmas songs, and you know, like it was this weird 80s moment. But, you know, it to me, like, I'm like, yeah, television and Christmas. And that sounds so cheap and tacky.
No, it sounds poignant because I think about you looking for happiness in a television screen when, at least at the time, there must have been a lot of misery in your house.
Right, right. And that's Christmas to me, too. happy and miserable all rolled into one. And that's why this book sometimes makes people think, boy, that was a downer. You know, there's a lot of down moments in this book that are very real that happened in the now, happened to these families. But there's a lot of joy in it, too. And there's a lot of cheap and trashy to go along with it.
What do you do for Christmas?
Lately, the last several years, Michael and I go up to his mom's house. His mother and stepfather live about 40 minutes outside of Washington. And we have little traditions. The family goes out for Chinese food on Christmas Eve because we don't want to cook. And then to this big Hunan Manor restaurant that's always mobbed with families just like us. And then that night, people go to bed. Michael and I watch TV, and we make monkey bread, which is, you know, Pillsbury dough rolled up, cinnamon, you know, in a bundt pan, which we've always had for brunch the next morning. Michael and his brother used to make that, and or his mom used to make it for them. And so Michael has this idea that we should have monkey bread. Which the Christmas I spent in Frisco, the eve before Christmas Eve, I was shopping with Jeff and Bridget, and in the freezer, I saw the freezer section, I saw like microwavable monkey bread, and my heart just broke right there because I thought, wow, I have gotten so involved in other people's Christmases for this book that I'm missing my own. So, you know, the last part of the book is called Baby, Please Come Home.
So this year you guys are going to be together.
This year we're going to be together, and we're going to get a special getaway out to the desert. We're kind of having just a together Christmas, an anti-Christmas, very few presents, if any. And hopefully tinsel will be a lowercase word if it comes up at all.
Do you think that you were searching in all of this for Christmas that was so over the top that you could sort of let American Christmas go from your own perspective?
Yeah, and that backfired. You know, I did find the biggest Christmas I could find, and I did find people who really believe in it and really love it and came out of it yearning again to have it for myself. So this year is kind of like, for me, after I get done promoting this book, it's sort of like Control-Alt-Delete Christmas, like a reboot of Christmas, like next year. And I know there are so many songs about Christmas that sing about next year and how happy we'll be, but next year I'm going to figure it out.
Do you think it'll be harder, though? I mean, you know, Renata called, and we've talked about this a little bit, the fact that everybody thinks it's too extreme, mm-hmm. and after all the presents are opened
it
and all the food's
extreme.
Eaten.
Yeah.
But people, you know, the next year comes around, and people swear they're going to resist, and it becomes hard, the lure of the way we're told to do things.
Right. We're addicted to the Christmas that we have, and there are good reasons for that. I think a lot of it's wrapped up in hope. We hope next year will be better. So many Christmas songs sing about that. You know, I'll be home next year. I wish I was there this year. Or we'll be happier next year. Things will work out better. And retailers really know that we're very vulnerable at this time of year. We're trying to make everything okay. And we have been conditioned in our society to buy one another things to express our love.
Hank Stuever is my guest. He's a pop culture writer for The Washington Post, and his new book is called Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. He actually has two signings coming up. One is tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Frisco. The other takes place tomorrow at 7 at Legacy Books in Plano. Hank, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
I've really enjoyed it, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, very early. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.